from Buffalo Toronto Public Media and WBFO. This is What's Next. Today, we revisit a standout conversation heard on a previous episode.
Black Lives Matter. Saving Black lives, you know, is important. And, you know, preventing the next generation of youth from becoming replacement smokers is critical, you know, to our history, to our country, to our future. We cannot say that, you know, health equity matters if we don't address menthol tobacco, if we don't remove menthol, you know, from the shelves.
Public health advocate and founder of Stan Martin Consulting, Stan Martin, alongside the director of training, content, and development at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, Sarah Pearson Collins. They sat with Thomas O'Neill White to discuss the reasons behind the idea of a ban on menthol tobacco products and quitting tobacco solutions.
Tobacco use, specifically menthol cigarette use, has been ingrained in the Black community. We know that menthol is more addictive than non-menthol cigarettes in some cases. What is the history behind menthol products being sold and pushed in the Black community? Stan?
You know, when we look at historically the appropriation or misappropriation, how you want to frame it, in regards to menthol tobacco, at the root of your question is the African-Americanization of menthol tobacco in the Black community. One of my mentors and colleagues, you know, Dr. Gardner, he liked to frame it as this in terms of in the early 50s, less than 10% of African-Americans or those who identify with the Black diaspora smoked menthol tobacco. Then fast forward, or even in between there, today, 85% of African-Americans who smoke menthol tobacco. And the reason being, over that period of time, you know, there was a free marketing, or I should say free giveaways, the Lucy cigarettes, you know, the sponsorship of different festivals, concerts, you know. I'm dating myself a little bit when you think about the Cool Jazz Festival for some of our listeners. That was about menthol, you know, so that was about really, really trying to mask a business, an organization that produces a product when used as intended, kills people. And, you know, it was successful.
Yeah. I think for, if we're looking historically, you know, it can be traced. So tobacco itself can be traced all the way back to slavery, a crop. It's a, you know, it was a crop. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you think about your ancestors, how they grew it, they picked it, they smoked it, you know, because the access to it. And so I think it starts further back than just, I mean, of course, in the 1950s, there's this big promotion for the menthol piece of it, but even just tobacco itself being traced all the way back, you know, into the 1600s,
1700s, 1800s. Absolutely.
You know. And Sarah, you've got your own family history with tobacco.
I do.
And you wrote a really powerful op-ed in the Buffalo News. Do you mind sharing?
Yeah, so I think that I've watched my family smoke for years. I don't even know how I even got here, you know, being a tobacco advocate, but I'm thinking back as far as being a child and attending family functions and having a great time, you know, in the kitchen would be coffee and cigarettes. I mean, and they're just smoking one after the other. And you watch it, but you don't really pay attention. And some of the younger kids would go and steal cigarettes and they go back, you know, in the back and smoke. And so this was like part of the family dynamics, culture. That's how they communicated. That's how they socialized. And it wasn't until later in the 1990s that you actually started seeing the harm that came from the cigarettes, with a lot of my family members getting sick and then dying ultimately from tobacco-related diseases.
Now, is that what kept you from smoking? Just the understanding that this is going to cause this, this, and this?
I don't think I even paid attention to the fact that it was causing you to become sick. When I was younger, like the smoke itself was so irritating towards me. Like, I have allergies. So I couldn't be in this space with them for long periods of time. You know, you would sleep at certain houses where I went to the houses that didn't have the smoke because it would really affect me physically. So,
and that smoke,
I just stayed away.
Everything.
I don't like the smell of it. And just, you know, my eyes would be running and coughing and hacking. And so I just kind of stayed away from it. And I guess that was a deterrent. My parents didn't smoke either. So it wasn't something that was condoned or even, you know, an access to it in our household. I mean, I think everybody tries it when they get into college for 2 seconds. For 2 seconds, the and then pressure, he's like, "This is
the peer pressure is real, right?" You know, and Sarah, thank you for sharing your story. And I think one of the things I would, you know, really also like to, you know, highlight is that what Sarah was also speaking to was the normalization, mm-hmm. you know, of tobacco use in the Black community, and how it was heavily marketed, mm-hmm. how it was advertised. You know, whether, remember in our households, you could be sitting around, you know, or in the living room, you might see, you know, Ebony or Life, yeah. or Jet Magazine, yep. and the amount of advertising, tobacco advertising that was in magazines at that point in time. Or if you're, you know, traveling through the community, going to the grocery store, to and from school, you know, the enormous amount of tobacco advertising on billboards to and from school, to the grocery store. So, you know, seeing those slogans, you know, alive with pleasure, or showing or promoting a lifestyle that people aspire to be and to live, and the tobacco industry capitalizing on that and say, this is a way that we can infiltrate, you know, the Black community. This is a way that we can promote, you know, our poison, our product, to normalize its use. And that's a, you know, a part of the whole strategy as well.
And it's specifically menthol cigarettes. Because mm-hmm. I remember reading a Jet, reading Ebony, and seeing those menthol cigarettes as opposed to, you know, reading like a Sports Illustrated or something that's like Marlboro or Camel or something like that.
Absolutely.
Really interesting to look back on that. Stan, can you tell us about the work you've done both with CAI, which you no longer work for, but and also outside of CAI?
Absolutely. I've been very fortunate to work with, you know, tremendous individuals such as Sarah, who's here with us today, as well as, you know, other organizations locally, Roswell Park Cancer Institute, Pastor Nicholas at Buffalo Center of Health Equity, as well as others here in this community who are champions, ambassadors to really protecting the life and well-being of others. And on the national level, the African American Tobacco Control Leadership Council out of California and the Center of Black Health and Equity. And I share that because this is an effort that's happening nationally and locally, and we're all saying the same thing, and that is Black Lives Matter. Saving Black lives, you know, is important. And, you know, preventing the next generation of youth from becoming replacement smokers is critical, you know, to our history, to our country, to our future. And we cannot say that, you know, health equity matters if we don't address menthol tobacco, if we don't remove menthol, you know, from the shelves. As you mentioned earlier, menthol was created specifically to help the poison, as we, some of us like to say, go down smoother,
you right.
know, easier. You know, you inhale, you digest it deeper in your lungs, you know, in your body. So, you know, it helps to mask that harshness. It helps to mask, you know, some of the other, you know, carcinogens and poisons that come along, you know, with, you know, smoking tobacco. And let's be real clear, we're talking about commercial tobacco, combustible tobacco, not traditional tobacco. Mm-hmm. So I really want to, you know, make that clear in terms of our subject matter today.
And the thought was, you know, before all this research and these studies came out, that menthol cigarettes were somehow healthier because when you inhaled, it wasn't as harsh.
Correct. Right.
And then you can see even the advertisement or the marketing practices. If you think about the advertisements in the 60s and 70s, you have doctors, you know, and they're saying, you know, it's a win-win, you know, because it gives you a cool, fresh perspective when you're smoking it. And it's easier. It's more palatable. So, you know, if you have a doctor that's advertising, you know, in a magazine, so you're thinking, of course, it's going to be healthier.
Right.
You know,
and one of the other, I would say, populations, I know where we've been focusing primarily on the African-American population, specifically to this point, you know, the tobacco industry, they're snakes. I'm just going to call it. Okay. You know, that, you know, a snake is a snake. And in terms of their marketing and advertising, you know, they've also targeted the LGBTQIA population,
Hispanic.
You know, Hispanic mm-hmm. population, mm-hmm. other marginalized populations specifically for profit. So when you look at their history, I think it's very telling. Even women, you know, even like children, you know, as I mentioned earlier, targeting or replacing those that Sarah spoke to that can no longer smoke.
I'd be remiss if I didn't give a shout out to Pastor George,
yes.
who you mentioned earlier. Great guy, doing a lot for the community as a whole in Buffalo and Western New York. What are the tolls on a person and to the large community that tobacco use takes.
I think when you, and Sarah, please, I know you can speak to this eloquently as well. You know, when you look at tobacco, let's just say African-American population, mm-hmm. over 80, 85% of African-Americans who smoke menthol tobacco. Okay. When you look at annually, that means that 45,000 African-Americans die each year as a result of menthol tobacco use. Tobacco use affects every part of your body, every organ of your body. So you talk about cancer, when you look at cancer, you look at lung cancer, when you look at stroke, when you look at diabetes, or when you look at, you know, other chronic illnesses, respiratory illnesses, et cetera, it impacts every part of one's body.
Inflammation, diseases, it affects your eyes, your teeth. So, mm-hmm. you know, some people don't think, oh, well, I didn't have cancer, but they may have issues pertaining to teeth. There's tumors that grow, you know, and I'm just thinking about even just from my family's perspective. So, no, they did not get cancer, but then they may have had like rheumatoid arthritis, which is inflammation disorders, you know, fertility issues. So there's a lot of different things, and people just think, oh, it's just the cancer, but there's a lot of health factors or health risks solely based on smoking.
Right, right. And when you look at the totality, even though in terms of, say, African Americans, we may start smoking at a later age or smoke less, we die more mm-hmm. as a result of those, you know, exacerbated health conditions. So, you know, this is a serious health issue, a public health crisis. And, you know, we're, once again, we want to raise awareness, we want to educate, we want to help people to make an informed decision. And, you know, at the same time, you know, we want to make sure that we're holding those accountable, responsible, you know, for the death and disease that's totally, you know, preventable.
But to play devil's advocate for...
The devil don't need no help. But go ahead, Doug.
To play devil's advocate for a quick minute, some folks would say, you know, why not just let people enjoy what they want to enjoy? If they're consenting adults, just let them have their smoke, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the things I would like to say is that we're not against people, or I'm not against those who smoke or utilize tobacco. Mm-hmm. We are against, you know, the tobacco industry intentionally targeting and marketing a deadly product. You know, when used as intended, will kill you, will kill people. So when you're talking about menthol in particular, there's tremendous health disparities in terms of 85% of African Americans that I mentioned earlier who smoke menthol. Mm-hmm. Well, less than 30% of whites, or those, you know, non-African Americans, smoke menthol tobacco. So there's a huge disparity there. So if we can assist those who are trying to quit, to quit, and to reduce those health disparities, to lessen them, then why wouldn't we? You know, so we have a moral responsibility to really provide a environment where everyone thrives, you know, where our children can live a long life, you know, and... Go ahead, Sarah.
No, I was just thinking when you asked that question, so, you know, when you poll people who want to quit, 70% of people actually want to quit. There's only 30% that's actually ready to quit. So there's a very big group or percentage of people who really do want to quit. It's not like, oh, we're just, you know, we just like to do this. People don't, you know, mm-hmm. The cost is, you know, going up every day.
Right.
You know, they're noticing health effects from the smoking. You know, it affects, not only affects the person who's smoking, but it affects everyone around them. Because if you have children, you know, you've got the second and third hand smoke. You know, you have the caregivers who will be responsible for these people once they get to a place where they can't take care of themselves. So it's not just, you know, my own decision that I want to smoke, but everyone is affected around them when they make this decision.
Right. And going back once again, when you look at this impact on tobacco, Sarah mentioned how the vast majority of people who smoke, a large proportion, do want to quit. And we do know that, for example, if menthol, let's say menthol was banned today, all right, over a quarter of a million African American lives will be saved as a result of a ban on menthol tobacco. So this has huge implications in terms of saving lives, providing a safer, healthier environment for our children, for the next generation, and addressing the health inequities that exist and disparities as a result.
What are the next steps then? to ban menthol cigarettes locally and nationally. I know recently there was a menthol funeral in January in Washington, D.C. Stan, you were supposed to go, but due to the litany of winter storms we had in January, you were unable to go. But can you talk about the event?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. The menthol ban funeral in Washington, D.C. was actually championed by the African-American Tobacco Control Leadership Council, as well as a host of other advocates from across the country, where individuals, organizations such as myself from California to Washington to Atlanta and, you know, Wisconsin and far beyond, really held a menthol funeral in Lafayette Park down in Washington. And they really was to really call on the Biden administration to really fulfill this promise. And that their promise was that to the African-American people that they would make a decision to ban menthol tobacco by the end of this year. But however, you know, that decision has been delayed, and that decision has deadly consequences, you know, daily on the Black community. I think one of the reasons why I know for sure that the reason that it was delayed was because some of the tobacco provocateurs, you know, lobbyists, what have you, said that, or, you know, their message was that it would cost Black votes, it would cost the administration, you know, to lose support for another term. And pretty much those key messages was that it would create a illicit market, which a illicit market already exists, you know, for tobacco, as well as it would increase policing in the African-American and the Black communities. Those are some key issues and that they need to be addressed. However, the ban on menthol really is not on criminalization. There's nothing in the ban about someone will be arrested for possession of menthol tobacco. You know, that's ludicrous, all right? Jedi mind trick, as we say. It places the onus on the manufacturer and on the retail sales of tobacco. So, you know, that is fear-mongering, the gaslighting, scare tactics that has been utilized to not only with the administration, but also with the public community at large. So what we've been trying to do, and we're going to continue to do, is to really to educate the community residents in regards to what the, not just what the legislation is about, but also the impact of menthol tobacco. And in addition, to help those who want to quit, to quit. So locally, what we've been doing here, fast forward, is to really look at meeting with our local councils, councilmen, our elected officials, our government entities that really can put pen to paper, you know, to move a ban on menthol forward. So, and that's at every level. So the local, city, the state, and county.
I think some people would argue that the Black community can't be any more policed. And so it's disheartening to hear that lobbyists would make the claim that more policing would occur in the Black community with trying to eliminate menthol cigarettes. You talk about putting pressure on local electeds. Now, is that going to go up the chain? Local, city, state?
It's already happening.
It's already happening?
It's already happening. Actually, we and several faith leaders from the city of Buffalo, we've actually already been on a conference call with the White House, with the Biden administration, you know, alerting them, but sharing with them what's happening here at the local level. Since the menthol funeral, I believe that was on January 18th in D.C., since that time, myself and others, we've met with Senator Chuck Schumer. We've been in constant conversation with the Buffalo Common Council, you know, who's developed a, you know, a resolution at this point in time, and they're looking at taking some other steps moving forward based upon some of the information that we provided to them. And we believe that there is tremendous support at the city and potentially even the county level as well. So we're doing our due diligence. And I just want to really once again emphasize moving forward the importance of reaching out to our community, our grassroots organizations, to partner with them, to come alongside them, to really, you know, show that this is a part of a movement, a national and local movement, you know, to save Black lives.
And then I guess from the clinical standpoint with Roswell Park, when this ban takes place, you know, what do we do with all of these people who smoke menthol and want to quit? So being able to develop content that is individualized to meet the needs of folks, excuse me, who are smoking menthol and be able to provide services for, you know, helping them to stop smoking, you know, providing some type of counseling and support or coaching and support, and being able to also give them the appropriate nicotine replacement therapies so that they would be effective with quitting. Because we know that with the menthol added to the nicotine really makes mm-hmm. the quit rates more difficult. So mm-hmm. they have a lower quit rate. And of course, we know that there's also barriers and things in place that prevent them from quitting. But then just those two ingredients together really makes it more difficult with the quitting efforts.
On the ground level, when you speak with someone who is trying to quit, what are those conversations like, and what's kind of a strategy that you plan out for them?
So basically, when we're taking them through an interview, we want to find out how much they're smoking. You know, we want to know what their triggers are. We want to know, you know, when and where do you smoke the most? You know, so they give us a list of things, you know, while I smoke in the car, I'm smoking when I go on my breaks. And then we're creating a list of why they may be smoking. Is it emotionally? Is it a physiological response? Or is it a situation? So then we're looking at those situations, looking at those emotions, and we're doing a cognitive behavioral approach where we're addressing those situations and, you know, well, what can you do instead? That sort of thing. We know the physiological responses, the nicotine replacement therapy is going to be the most effective thing for that because that's what it addresses. But it does not address the issues like I'm smoking when I get up in the mornings. So it's almost like a problem solving. Well, what can you do to start to prepare them for this quit date? So that they will be ready when these situations occur. Because, of course, you've started smoking, you know, you're addicted, but then it's also become a habit.
Right.
So it's breaking habits. It's a behavioral change. So looking at, you know, what we're doing and then breaking the chain and replacing it with something that's more healthier.
One of the things that we're going to be doing at SMC, Stan Martin Consulting, we're going to be launching a program called Free and Proud, which is a tobacco cessation program with Dr. Karen Beard out of California, who also works with the African American Tobacco Control Leadership Council, to really look at menthol specifically and look at how, as Sarah described, like what are the challenges, but also what are the assets or, you know, other tools that might be necessary to help someone who want to quit to quit. So making it a little bit more culturally and linguistically, you know, appropriate, you know, for folks.
Addressing the issues that are commonly found or within those particular marginalized groups and being able to address them.
So it's very important. Like, we want to really emphasize. So it's not like, you know, we don't understand or we're insensitive to that this is a addiction. All right. And some, not everyone can quit cold turkey. Some people
24%
need. Wow, you see what I'm 24% saying?
24% can quit cold turkey.
So a lot of people need more resources. So and we want to be that pathway. We want to create that access, you know, to those services, you know, to help those, you know, who are, you know, struggling.
That was Thomas O'Neill White with Stan Martin and Sarah Pearson Collins. Recently, Thomas O'Neill White caught up with Stan Martin to get an update on what progress has been made since his last appearance. Here is their conversation.
So we had you on with Sarah Pearson Collins from Roswell Park back in February, and we discussed the state of menthol-flavored tobacco products in this country and here locally, plus the adverse health effects caused by tobacco use. And we talked about how big tobacco has been targeting the African American community for generations.
Yes. You know, I mean, thank you once again for having me, Thomas, and it's a pleasure to be here. You know, as you mentioned, you know, during Black History Month, you know, we met and, you know, we had the opportunity to share at that particular time in terms of the national movement to end the sale of menthol tobacco and to really raise awareness in terms of how, you know, the current administration, you know, the Biden administration and the FDA and other elected officials have been really, you know, like delaying in terms of making a decision to end the sale of menthol tobacco nationally. You know, this is something that has already been done, and we may even talk about this later on, but it's been done in California. It's been done in Massachusetts, Canada, and EU. And based upon, you know, all the research and science that, you know, we have uncovered, I would say that, you know, with assistance from the Public Health Law Center, et cetera, we quickly wanted to pivot to shifting the conversation to locally. mm-hmm. you know, and amplifying that conversation, because this is something that, you know, we don't have to wait for Washington. We don't have to wait on, you know, New York State to do this. This is something that, quite honestly, the Buffalo Common Council as a legislative body can end the sale of menthol here in the city of Buffalo itself.
So what are the numbers? You know, we talk about how these cigarette companies target African Americans
right.
to some degree, but like, what are the numbers with people who smoke and the demographics?
Yeah, well, you know, let's start broadly. When you look at over 400,000 people, you know, who smoke die annually as a result of tobacco use, which is totally preventable. When we break those numbers down, when we look at, you know, those who identify with the Black diaspora, you know, 45,000 African Americans die each year as a result of menthol tobacco use. You know, so, you know, that's something that, you know, when we're talking about.
And I just wanted to jump in real
sure.
quick. Specifically from menthol tobacco
yes.
use.
Yes, absolutely. Because here's the deal. When we look at, you know, those numbers, 85% of African Americans who smoke menthol tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, when you even go even deeper to those numbers, 45,000, you know, die annually as a result of directly in terms of menthol tobacco use and other correlated, you know, health effects or diseases. So, you know, you're talking about, you know, cancer, you're talking about lung cancer, you talk about, you know, stroke and heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so menthol itself. And, you know, I know that some of your listeners and others may have heard this, or maybe not. You know, menthol sweetens the poison. You know, it masks the harshness, you know. And I was actually having this conversation with someone yesterday when I was doing some of my community outreach. And they were like, what's the big deal with menthol? You know, why is that, you know, why is that such an issue? And I was just sharing with them in terms of, It masks the flavor, you know, it masks the poison, what have you. You inhale deeper, you know, it has it's easier to start and harder to quit. So, you know, when we look at our youth in particular, you know, going back to the harshness, you know, the vast majority of youth, over 50% of them start with a flavored product, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Typically menthol. So,
right.
You know, and we know that based upon the science that in terms of those who smoke, who want to quit, in particular, you know, we find the science shows that because of the menthol, it makes it even harder to quit. So by ending the sale of menthol, you know, we can prevent the next generation of you from becoming replacement smokers, because you smoke, you die.
Yeah,
or,
right.
Unfortunately, no disrespect, that's just a harsh reality. And also, we know that it's harder to quit. So we're offering an off-ramp. And the vast majority of those who smoke want to quit. So here's an off-ramp, an exit ramp that we're trying to provide the community and help others to do so successfully.
So why do you think that the government is dragging their feet, so to speak?
Right.
As you say, what's the delay?
Yeah. Well, so that's
at least
I would love
the federal level.
Yeah. Well, that's a question I would love for at any level, federal, state, city to answer. And I'm gonna, you know, just share based upon from someone who's been involved with this type of work for over two decades. You know, I know it might not sound like it, but yeah, or look like it, but still, you know, the tobacco industry, you know, they have deep pockets.
Yeah.
You know, they have lobbyists, you know, they have provocateurs, and, you know, they've done their job just in terms of, you know, doing a lot of fear mongering, doing a lot of gaslighting of the issue. And what I mean by that, you know, this is a election year. And, you know, quite frankly, I think at the federal level that, you know, the current administration, you know, was, you know, are fearful that it's going to cost them votes, in particular, the Black votes, you know, in particular. So I think that in addition to that in itself, with the lobbying and, you know, the things of that nature, that the tobacco industry, just like with guns, you know, they invest a lot of money into those type of campaigns, you know, and therefore, you know, the provocateurs, you know, continue to create confusion, dissension, chaos, and, you know, therefore we continuously, unfortunately, we see delays when it comes to, you know, this particular subject matter.
Do you feel that you're fighting an uphill battle?
Actually, yes. You know, quite honestly, I feel that, you know, I've always said this over the years I've been involved with, you know, tobacco control and other health initiatives. You know, we might not be able to match their dollars, but they can't match our will. Mm. You know, so when I look at the different advances, you know, going for, not to, you know, give a history lesson, however, you know, being involved with clean indoor air, being involved with, you know, smoke-free housing, you know, being involved with smoke-free parks and beaches, you know, being involved, you know, with other initiatives that save lives, you know, I know that information alone doesn't change behavior. You know, the environment has to change along with that. So, you know, we're trying to change, when I say we, you know, it's not just myself, it's several other community partners, organizations. I'm going to give a shout out if I can.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
To, you know, Pastor Nicholas, you know, the Buffalo Center of Health Equity.
Yeah, Pastor George. You
know, Pastor George, my man. And also some of the national partners that we're working with, the African American Tobacco Control Leadership Council, Campaign for Tobacco for Kids, and the National Center for Black Health and Equity. And our local partners, Roswell Park, you know, who we'll probably talk about later. But, well, in addition to that, you know, we have been able to mobilize others and at the grassroots level to go upstream. You know, others might want us to, you know, wait downstream and delay and say, okay, well, you know, let's play nice, you know, let's save one person at a time. Whereas though that is effective, however, it's not as effective as going upstream and actually changing the environment and social norms that would save millions of lives.
So playtime is over.
Yes, playtime. The gloves are off. playtime is definitely over, you know.
And this is part of the No Menthol Buffalo campaign?
Absolutely.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that.
Yes, you know, No Menthol Buffalo, the campaign is comprised of, I want to say we have 10 to 12 community champions, those with lived experience, smokers and non-smokers, who, you know, really, you know, believe that, you know, this is a important issue, you know, in terms of saving lives, you know, saving youth from becoming replacement smokers, as I mentioned, but also helping those who want to quit to quit. You know, we know more today than we did before in terms of the science and in terms of the harmful effects of not just tobacco, but flavored tobacco. And, you know, this is an opportunity that others have, you know, mobilized to come together with a shared mission and vision, you know, to say that enough is enough. You know, so, I mean, we're looking at not just, you know, reducing health disparities among African Americans, you know, those identified with the Black diaspora, mm-hmm. but also our Hispanic and Latino brothers and sisters who we know that have been targeted as well, intentionally, as yes. well as the, you know, LGBTQIA plus, you know, community.
Absolutely.
You know, and, you know, there's, you know, I just want to pause for a moment because of the fact that these are all communities that have been underserved at some point in time, that are vulnerable, that are dealing with some of the greatest needs. Let me put it that way, and
yes.
the least amount of resources. So what the tobacco industry does, they come in and try and play nice or try and pretend that, you know, they're a responsible business or organization, what have you, and, you know, they're here to help. When actually all that they do is, you know, and I'm just going to say, you know, just create havoc and cause death and destruction, you know. So buying their silence or buying the silence, you know, of our elected officials and civic organizations is unacceptable.
And that kind of ties into what you've been doing since October.
Yes.
You've gone in front of Buffalo's Common Council's Community Development Committee every single month.
Pretty much,
Since October to provide them with information from Roswell Park and the Public Health Law Center. What is the info you have shared with the council?
Yeah, so myself, as well as the others, you know, from the coalition that I mentioned, as we've shared with information from the Public Health Law Center, you know, who has been very instrumental in passing legislation with some of the other areas like that I mentioned in terms of California and Massachusetts,
yes,
you know, as well as other local municipalities, in terms of passing legislation in this manner. we've gone before them. We presented a policy which places the onus, you know, on the tobacco industry in terms of, and also places the onus on the retailers not to sell menthol tobacco. It removes or absolves anyone from being in possession of smoking.
You're not going to get arrested.
You're not going to get arrested, you know. And even when I talk to some police officers, they're like, come on, are you really serious? Who has time to do that?
Yeah, right.
But, you know, this is not that. So we've taken that heat out of that fire, out of that argument, you know. So this is, once again, and if you're in compliance, you know, with the law, then, you know, you don't have to worry about, you know, losing your business or losing your licensing, you know, to sell other products. You know, there's stipulations within that in terms of being in compliance and doing what you say that you're going to do as a responsible business, as a responsible entrepreneur in this community, you know. So, the argument, I think, once again, becomes whether or not they want to put, you know, the public health over the profit of retailers and big tobacco.
Right. And what has been the council's response? Yeah.
Well, I would say this, that, you know, definitely I would say that, you know, Councilman, you know, Rashid Wyatt, you know, has been a champion, you know, surrounding this issue. You know, he's been very supportive. You know, we've had some changes, you know, in the Common Council, you know, over the, you know, mm-hmm. past few months or what
yeah,
have
we
you.
Have.
So, you know, really bringing others up to speed and catching up, you know, to, you know, if you say that Black Lives Matter, if you say that, you know, the health and welfare, you know, of your constituents matter, you know, then here's an opportunity to you know, put action behind your words.
And so the council is investigating legality of trying to ban menthol?
Right. And going back to your point, one of the things that as we shared information, we've been repeatedly, you know, told that, well, it's just something that we can do. It's just something that we, you know, can even pursue. And, you know, they've had, you know, their city attorneys, you know, look into, you know, the legality or the power, you know, or what are their options.
Yes.
We've been waiting. Actually, we met with them, I want to say early April. Once again, we know that they have the power and authority to do this. Mm-hmm. However, as a delay tactic, in my opinion, you know, they wanted to do their own, which I encouraged, their own research or what have you. We met with them in April, and we were told that we were going to get the findings, you know, of that investigation or that research within 30 days. It is now July. July 10th.
It is July 10th.
July 10th. So meeting with them April 9th, you know, you do the math. You know, we still haven't received that information as of yet. And we know that, you know, they're about to, you know, go on summer break or what have you, mm-hmm. and they won't be returning until September. So, this is just something that, you know, I and others believe that is important. And one of our colleagues, you know, came up with the phrase, we ain't playing, we stand. So, mm-hmm. you know, we're doing a lot of our due diligence on the ground and also at the highest level to see this come to fruition.
So is it's my understanding that there is no more. We're in July and they go out of session in August. Is there another time between now and then that you could be back in Common Council chambers?
I think that, you know, that is our goal, to try and get back in before the
before the recession
that happens. But if not, you know, it is what it is, and we will continue to do what we, you know, what we've been doing, and that is to provide awareness surrounding this issue, to educate the community in terms of not just of the harmful effects of menthol tobacco, but also on the importance of amplifying their voices and, you know, voting. You know, just as people are voted in, you know, people can also be, you know, held accountable for not, you know, mm-hmm. Doing what's in the best interest of public health and welfare.
Is that like kind of like point one in raising awareness? Like, hey, you've got the ability to vote, so make your voice heard there first.
Absolutely. And create a platform where, as though, you know, amplifying the voices of constituents, you know, amplifying the voices of young children. you know, mm-hmm. kids. You know, when I look at some of the, you know, I love data, I love information. And, you know, when I look at some of the data, you know, 280,000 youth 18 years of age today here in New York State will die prematurely, all right, as a result of tobacco use.
Wow.
And connect that to what I said earlier, shared earlier, about the vast majority, over 50% of youth who start smoking because of, you know, menthol tobacco, or flavored tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
All right, 280,000 people, that's equivalent to the number of residents here in the city of Buffalo
that's
itself.
The city of Buffalo.
You know, so just imagine, you know, this, you know, come on, this is a city that's vibrant. This is a city that's full of life. You know, this, we're not the walking dead. You know,
mm-hmm.
so I think that we have a chance to, you know, do something that is transformative. And I like to say that because, you know, some of the things that we've heard is that, well, you know, let's wait and see what the state is going to do. Let's, you know, people are punting this down the field.
Yeah, right, right,
you
right.
Know? And it angers me because, you know, we can be the head and not the tail of the state. We don't have to wait on New York City. We don't have to wait on, you know, the Biden administration. You know, Governor Hochul tried this, you know, last year. Unfortunately, you know, she didn't follow through with it, you know, because, you know, there was, you know, pushback and opposition. Even though we were out here championing this, you mm-hmm. know, this effort, you know, still at that time, you know, that decision was made, you know, to pull it back, to roll it back. However, we've continued to roll things forward.
Yeah. Could you go to state lawmakers again?
Absolutely. Well,
and I mean, obviously, if the Common Council is doing its own investigation, I mean, maybe you talk to state lawmakers about this.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that going back to our partnership, Roswell Park, and you know, and others, you know. In terms of who are involved with tobacco control, and that's funded by the state, New York State Department of Health, mm-hmm. Bureau of Tobacco Control. They have legislative day each year, which I think is in February, around the parts of late January, early February. But anyway, where so they go and they speak to, you know, elected officials, state elected officials about this very issue. You know, however, one of the things where I think there's a gap sometimes is that there's a disconnect in terms of what's happening at the state level and then locally at the mm-hmm. municipality level.
Right.
So that oftentimes is not a continuance.
That's government for you.
Right. Exactly. So, and here it is where others such as myself and, you know, other partners really step in. We're that bridge. You know, we fill that void or that gap, you know, to keep, you know, this conversation, you know, not just going, but going into a place where so is creating action, you know, and it's holding people accountable for doing what they say they were going to do and accountable for what they're not doing
mm-hmm.
as well.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to What's Next, and we are on with Stan Martin, founder and CEO of Stan Martin Consulting and a partner in the No Menthol Buffalo campaign. Are there any state or national events happening this summer that is related to your campaign or just, you know, the campaign of getting people to quit smoking?
Yeah, I think one of the, in terms of nationally, some of the things that has been happening, actually, we held one of these last year. We did a No Menthol funeral.
Yes.
And that's no laughing matter. You know, I'm just saying mm-hmm. that, you know, we've held one here in Buffalo last year, and that's something that, you know, has been held, you know, across this country at the national level. And that's something that, you know, we may be looking at doing, you know, during this, you know, stoppage, you know, as a... you know, as a way once again to, you know, raise awareness and bring it home,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of, you know, the impact of tobacco use, menthol in particular, you know, here in the city of Buffalo. We know that, you know, based upon our partnership with Roswell Park, I want to say that, you know, I'm just going to put it this way, you know, that the number of deaths, in particular within the African-American community, almost one person from that diaspora dies each week as a result of tobacco use or menthol tobacco use or related disease.
Wow.
So, you figure, you know, that's one person, mom, dad, brother, sister, sibling, who's not at the dinner table, you know, who won't be home for the holidays, you know, who, that's an empty seat at the table. Mm-hmm. So as we continue to delay and kick this and punt this and whatever you want to call it, you know, the harsh reality, you know, Thomas, is that people are dying.
Right. Right.
You know, so
plain and simple.
Plain and simple. No, we know that, you know, later on this year, you know, we have Great American Smokeout. You know, we'll certainly be doing, you know, something, you know, for Great American Smokeout. We have Breast Cancer Awareness, you know, month or what have you. So, you know, we're really trying to, you know, amplify this issue and also, once again, create that off ramp and prevent the next generation from ever starting.
As a quick aside, I don't think Great American Smokeout is the best title.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Okay.
Might attract the wrong people.
Right. That's something I would take that back from the people. Yes, I would definitely take that back. You know, to the committee. We may come up with something else. I will share this though with you. We've been locally, if I might add.
Yeah.
We've, as a result of our funding from the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids Action Fund, you know, we've been able to offer, you know, many grants to youth-serving organizations as well as faith-based organizations to really do what we cannot do alone. And that is really, you know, mobilizing youth, you know, to push back against the tobacco industry, to come up with some of their own counter-messaging, counter-marketing, you know, of what it means to live a healthy, long life. Working with faith leaders, working with, as I mentioned earlier, Pastor Nicholas, Reverend Kaiser Pointer, you know, as well, you know, to amplify and engage, you know, our faith leaders, you know, in this effort. We've also been able to provide some seed funding as a result of these mini grants to Hispanic Heritage Council, working very closely with Kaz Rodriguez, you know, a good friend of mine is over there.
Yes,
you know,
good friend of the show as well.
Great, yes. And others, you know, fraternities and sororities and just other like-minded organizations, you know, from the community that have been deeply impacted. Everyone probably has or knows someone who's been affected by tobacco use.
Yes.
You know, and when you look at that in one shape, form or another. So really, you know, mobilizing and bringing, you know, people and organizations and leaders, I mean, real leaders together, you know, that you don't sometimes hear about, you know, to once again do what we cannot do alone, you know, has, you know, been really, really rewarding and also purposeful.
This is as grassroots as it gets.
Yeah.
It really is.
Thank you.
And you know, uplifting the youth voice. I mean, I can't tell you how many people I've interviewed who have that, like, as one of their top priorities, like elevating, if it's affecting the youth,
right?
We need to hear from the youth in their own voices, in their own way.
Yes. So I'm excited about that. And, you know, even though No Menthol Buffalo, you know, and under the umbrella of Stan Martin Consulting LLC, you know, we've been bringing the youth youth together surrounding this issue, and the community is going to be hearing from our youth ambassadors over the next few months to come.
Oh, great. I would love to have them on.
Absolutely.
You know, I have this question. You know, Roswell is such a powerful institution here, and you know, even on a national level.
Right.
Could you lean on them a little more, to lean on our politicians?
Right.
Is that something that can be done? I mean, I don't want to put Roswell on the spot or anything like that. But you know, they hold so much sway, I think.
Right.
In this area and across the state.
I'll be honest with you, Thomas, and I'm very unapologetic, you know, when it comes to this particular subject matter, this topic and saving lives. I think there's more that Roswell can do. I think there's more that the mayor could do. I think there's more that the Common Council could do. I think there's more that, you know, community you know, can do,
mm-hmm.
you know, myself included. So I'm not absolved. So, okay. you know, certainly I think that as we're at a tipping point right now, you know, when it comes to this issue. And the fact that when you ask the question, which I appreciate and respect, you know, can others do more? And I would encourage our listeners, you know, whether you're an individual or organization, to answer that question yourself. What can you do? You know, what more can you do,
mm-hmm.
you know, to really save lives? You know, because I want to go back to, you know, the fact that this is the number one preventable cause of death and disease. You know, preventable.
Yeah, preventable. That's the key word.
You know? So, so whether it's, you know, someone like Roswell or even, you know, elected officials to the highest level in this city, you know, from the mayor on down. You know, to the Common Council, to, you know, community residents, community voices. You know, this is something that we need. We need not to ask. We need to demand,
mm-hmm.
you know, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you can only hold a group of people down for so long before they really start to, you know, demand the change that, you know, they deserve. You know, we talk a lot about equity. We talk a lot about, you know, the social determinants of health.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I'm a big one on just. You know, on, in terms of creating a world that's, you know, that's equitable, but also one that is just. And, you know, when I sit in the Common Council and I, you know, watch and, you know, we stand and, we go through the Pledge of Allegiance and the oath and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those last words, you know, justice for all. Well, what justice is there in this right here when you know that people are dying and you know that you have the ability to put pen to paper to save lives and you don't? Where's the justice in that? There is none.
It's powerful. That is powerful. Something that came across our desk recently was New York State Quitline has a new website section and services focused specifically on helping folks cut down or completely quit commercial menthol tobacco products. Seems like a step in the right direction. What are your thoughts?
I think that's excellent. Once again, you know, I think Roswell, this is an example of them saying, hey, what can we do? You know, what can we do more of? You know, so I think this is a direct result of the work that we've done over the last year and also that, you know, others funded to advance tobacco-free communities, Roswell included, you know, have, you know, are showing that, you know, their, you know, willingness to get in the fight. You know, I think that when you look at people of color and you look at, I'm going to say specifically, you know, African-Americans, their success rates in terms of quitting are not as high as other, you know, ethnic groups.
Does access play a part in that?
Access. And also, you know, you have to look at some of the historical trauma. You know, some of the, you know, other factors that, you know, in terms of the medical history, medical trauma,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, African-Americans don't have a lot of faith and a lot of trust in, you know. And then in addition, tobacco is one of those, and this is part of the conversation that I had with one of the persons who was visiting our outreach table. People think that, well, I can quit at any time. You know, when it comes to tobacco,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially young people. Well, you know, I'm going to smoke up to this point and then I'm going to quit.
Right.
You know,
right.
And before you know it, you know, someone is addicted, you know, someone is hooked on it. And, you know, we're not against those who smoke or those who, you know, are addicted to tobacco use or use tobacco. But we are against the tobacco industry, you know, intentionally targeting, you know,
mm-hmm.
people in vulnerable communities.
Yeah, you're
communities.
Targeting the system,
right.
not the person.
Yeah, yeah. And at the same time, recognizing that, you know, it is hard. You know, it takes 7 to 9 or more times to quit successfully. Young lady told me yesterday that her brother, it took him 21 times.
Wow.
You know, and those stories are not outliers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, a lot of people can identify with that, you know, who might be listening or know of someone. So, you know, we going back to your point, there's more that we can do,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it starts with not just looking at individual change. It also has to create, the environment has to create the change that is right. necessary for those who want to quit and to be successful.
But it also must feel good, or you know, have you must feel a sense of accomplishment to see that what the quit line is doing and say, oh yeah, well, we helped build that up.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to continuing to partner and work closely, you know, with Roswell Park and others, because we know that, and they've been in this game a lot longer than I have, mm-hmm. you know, because we know that every advance that we make, you know, every success, the tobacco industry is already, you know, like 10 steps down the road on that.
Right, right.
You know, so you know, we're going to enjoy
like,
it.
It's almost like a good criminal being against the cops.
Right.
they're staying three or four steps ahead.
Right. You know, so, we're definitely going to celebrate, and we're going to enjoy this victory right here. And, you know, we're going to enjoy our wins and celebrate our successes as well. And at the same time, we're going to keep our, what's that phrase? Keep our foot on the pedal, you know, mm-hmm. metal to the pedal, what have you,
yeah.
you know, and move forward. You know,
so then where do you see this campaign in 2 to 3 years?
Well, 2 to 3 years.
Where can you expand?
Yeah. Hopefully by next year we have menthol off the shelves. Next year being January 1 of 2025. You know, hopefully that will happen. But before then, hopefully over these next couple of months, we'll be able to, you know, really have some conversations with the Common Council, whether it's one more time before they go out on break mm-hmm. or when they return in September, that this type of legislation will go to vote and we'll see where people stand, and we will hold those accountable who stand against us, who stand against saving lives. You can't say that, you know, like that your constituent lives matter. You can't say that, you know, you're about saving children and concerned about their health and well-being, and, you know, vote against this legislation or such a policy.
Yeah. Is there a plan if the Common Council comes back to you and says, our hands are tied? Sorry.
Yeah. Well, if the Common Council, you know, does that, then, you know, we'll have to take a look at, you know, some other measures, some other strategies that we do have in our toolbox, you know, to move forward on. Absolutely.
That was Thomas O'Neill White with Stan Martin. If you missed anything or want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts or on the Amplify BTPM app. Each episode is online at WBFO.org. I'm Jay Moran, and thanks for listening.